This is a collection of recordings I made with some of the world's most knowledgeable, well-known, and successful whitetail hunters on the planet. I know you're really going to enjoy and learn from the wisdom they share, along with their personal life and their walk with God. I hope you enjoy these classic conversations.
Hey, I've got with me all the way from the great state of Iowa, we've got Bill Winky. Bill, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Man, it's good to have you here. Bill is an amazing speaker, an amazing writer. You've been an outdoor writer since, what, 1992, full-time?
Yeah, 92. I think I sold my first article in 91, and then wasn't too long after that, and I was in it full-time.
And you just started a new internet-only hunting show. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's we call it Midwest Whitetail, and it's on MidwestWhitetail.com. And what we do is produce hunting shows right during the hunting season. It's not the typical television show where the guys hunt and then 6 months or a year later, you're watching it on television. In some cases, it's, 6 hours later.
One of your most popular presentations was using the terrain for trophies. And you had, I was reading here, it said you've played a leading role in the management of thousands of acres of land for deer hunting. And a big part of your expertise is in reading and interpreting topographical maps and aerial photos for deer sign. That's become, really big. I mean, Google Maps, Google Earth. What do you use when you're doing this? Where do you go to find all this stuff?
Well, I use, you can go just about any place that has aerial photos, and there are a lot of resources for that now. But I use a website called mytopo.com, and they have a companion website that's mapcard.com, and that gives you unlimited access to the mapping that's available through them, which is the topographical maps and then also the aerial photos, and they're all recent. It's one of the most recent databases that they've tapped into. So basically what I'm doing is I'm taking the land apart by looking at the cover, using the aerial photos to look at the cover, and using the topographical maps to look at the terrain features. The broader, larger scale features, and especially the cover-related travel routes, are really clear and easy to see. It's pretty straightforward when you see a block of timber and then another block of timber and then a brushy fence line connecting the two. To me, it's pretty clear that when the rut comes, the bucks are going to be looking from, traveling from one doe concentration area to another, looking for does, and everybody thinks that there's some kind of, order to the rut, that the bucks do a certain thing and the does do a certain thing, but there really isn't. The bucks just go looking for the does, and they've got some ways that they can be more efficient in that process, using their noses and so forth, but basically they spend most of their time physically trying to find the does. So they cover a lot of ground, and obviously one of the key places that they're going to travel through are any kind of a funnel that's located between two places where does concentrate. So I just take the maps and the aerial photos, and I break them down, and I try to determine, which areas are going to be doe concentration areas, which are likely to be the feeding areas and which are likely to be the bedding areas that does use. And then just look for any kind of a bottleneck, any kind of an obvious terrain feature that they have to go around, like a ditch or, potentially crossings on creeks. Or I look for any opportunity like a brushy fence line that gives that traveling buck a little additional security, something that he can relate to when he's traveling from one of these doe concentration areas to another.
You said to me on the phone the other day as we were talking about the importance of maintaining natural deer movement. And we talked about, entrance and exit, going in and out of the woods. Say just a little bit about that.
The whole concept of not letting the deer know that you're hunting them. I mean, that's really the whole game. If you want to boil deer hunting down to one thing, it's hunting them without them knowing that you're hunting them. Because once they know, they start, their whole behavior changes, and they go from more of a natural movement, which is somewhat predictable, to, a nocturnal behavior. Sometimes they will completely move out of an area as a result of hunting pressure. But getting back specifically to your question on the entry and exit routes, that's probably the one aspect of keeping the deer from knowing that they're being hunted. When I go into a new area, or even when I'm hunting my existing properties that I've hunted for years, I basically hunt them backwards, or I set them up backwards. I find my entry and exit routes first, and then I try to find stand locations, the best stand locations that I can find along those entry and exit routes. So what I'm looking for are ditches or creeks or, you know, a low area or something where I can keep from being seen, smelled, and heard by, ideally, by every deer, you know, and not just the target bucks that you're after, because the body language of the other deer that you spook is going to transfer to the deer that you're actually hunting, even if they aren't the ones you're after. You can't overlook the importance of keeping every single deer from knowing that you're going in and out. And you start thinking about that, and all of a sudden, there's a lot of factors that come into play. You know, there's ground scent, there's airborne scent, there's the sight, the smell, hearing, you know, of hearing you coming and going. So there's a lot of elements that come into play. So there aren't very many entry and exit routes on any given piece of hunting property that are going to be, 100% foolproof. So finding those and taking advantage of them, to me, is a lot more of a factor in your ultimate success than finding the best spots with all the best buck sign and then setting up a stand there and then trying to figure out how to get in and out of there. I'd rather keep those high activity areas as fresh as possible, because if you hunt a high activity area and you hunt it wrong, basically what that means is you've educated a lot of deer. You know, that's the downside of a high activity area. Not only do you, you know, in theory see a lot of activity, you know, at least the first time in, but you also run the risk of educating a lot of deer if it's not a really good setup.
When I was a kid, my dad, you know, he wasn't a hunter, but he would always take me out. I mean, that's one thing I loved about my dad. He would still take me, but we made so many mistakes. You know, as a young kid, we would go in, and I can remember my dad, the last thing he would do before we got in the car to go hunting was he'd put on Old Spice. he didn't know any better, you know, yeah. And I'm sure we educated a lot of deer.
Yeah, no doubt. And most people do, you know, and even a lot of veteran hunters do. I mean, I see it all the time. And the mistakes that they make generally aren't their stand locations, you know, with regard to, they're not really necessarily hunting bad spots, but they're hunting spots that they can't get to and from without spooking deer. You know, and they just get lured, you know, it's just they see that, all that sign, and they see all these, you know, where these two ridges come together down in this valley, and they think, oh my gosh, every buck on this whole piece of property is going to cross through here. But it just becomes almost a liability, that stand location, because they just educate too many deer.
How much do you play back cover into your whole stand placement?
Probably not as much as I should. Most of the places that I hunt, the deer aren't real educated. You know, mature bucks are still mature bucks, and they don't like to travel much during the day. So that's the biggest challenge that we face. They're not necessarily super educated about, you know, guys in trees, but they just are, you know, they're just savvy, you know, from that standpoint. And it's not so much, like I said, if we were hunting areas that had a lot more hunting pressure, we would have to set up in locations that has more background cover. And we definitely, you know, we get picked off from time to time still, but it's not quite as bad as I'm sure in some areas where it's really the, you know, you're talking about Pennsylvania and some of those types of places. You have to think about, you know, how well concealed you are in the tree just as much as you do any other factor in locating the stand.
Yeah, we get a lot of, you know, the thermals because of the hillsides, you know, going up and coming down, and yeah. it gets a little bit tricky as opposed to some of the places in the Midwest. But I know that you get a pretty, you know, our wind, I don't know what yours is in Iowa, here in Indiana, it comes from the southwest heading to the northeast. So we have that northeast factor that's pretty predominant. I mean, I can pretty much count on that most of the time. But I know that the guys who are living in hilly areas have to deal with swirling winds and some different things.
Yeah, for sure. And that's another thing really quick, too, to touch on is, you know, another mistake I see a lot of people make, whether they're novices or experienced hunters, is they will set up down in those valleys. And it's really hard to get away with that because when the wind blows at all, it swirls down through those valleys. And there's no such thing as downwind. You know, every direction becomes downwind. And that's, you know, you just end up educating a lot of deer when you hunt those types of locations. So I just avoid them. You know, there's not much else you can do.
That's what I was going to ask. You know, if you've got a place, you know, with thermals going up in the morning and coming down in the evening, where are you doing your evening hunts?
Well, typically, if you have a more of a still evening, the problem we have in the Midwest and most areas where the whitetails are prevalent, other than say the Appalachians and maybe a few mountainous areas out west, there's not enough of a terrain difference from the tops to the bottoms to generate a thermal that overpowers the day wind. So if the wind forecast is for a southwest wind, it's going to be coming from the southwest, and it's going to, you know, whether you're halfway down the ridge or down in the bottom of the ridge, it's going to be swirling as relates to what a southwest wind does. However, when the winds are still, then we do run into some of these thermals where when the sun comes off the slopes, then the air cools and then it settles onto the slope and runs down the hill. So whenever the slope that you're sitting on is in the sun, the thermals are going to be going up. And when it's in the shade, in the shadow towards evening or in the first thing in the morning, the thermals will be going down. And sometimes you can hunt these low areas when the wind is basically low or non-existent, because the thermals will give you a predictable wind direction that you can count on. But if you don't have a really pretty still day, if you go down into the valleys, if they're narrow at all, I say anything less than 300 yards, 200 yards, probably at the very minimum wide, a valley that's any narrower than that, you're going to have swirling in there. If it gets wide enough, then the swirling occurs right at the slope. Then it's, you know, kind of straightens itself out as it goes across the bottom, and then it, you know, goes up the slope on the other side. So that's about your only bet. The other way you can get away with it is if you're hunting a valley that lines up with the wind direction, then you shouldn't have the same swirling effect that you'd have when the wind is cutting across the valley. So you could get a little bit more of a consistent wind, and you could figure out, you know, at least you know what downwind is.
Right. When you see these guys that do this a lot, what are the biggest mistakes these guys are probably doing?
One of the most obvious ones to me is parking too close to their hunting spot. Sounds almost too simple, but when you think about it, you know, you've been on stand before on a morning when it's pretty still out, and especially if you're set up near a gravel road, I mean, sometimes you can hear vehicles for 2 miles.
Yeah.
You know, just crunching along. And I'm not saying that you have to park 2 miles away, but think about it. If you park 200 yards away, I mean, basically that's got to sound like you're, you know, beating a bass drum when you pull up and stop. You know, the deer, that's not a normal thing to them. That's not something that happens all the time. It's not something that they ignore. They definitely take note of that. And then they kind of stand back and listen. They hear you, you know, click that door shut, and they hear you crunch, crunch, crunching through the woods. And, you know, basically you've told them ahead of time by parking too close that you're there. You're better off parking a long ways away, or what I like to do as often as I can is I park in some farmyard. You know, you know, I kind of mix in with the farm noises, you know, because a lot of farms fire up about the time that we're getting ready to head to our tree stands. You know, the guys are getting out and starting the tractors up, or, you know, getting things going around the farm. And I'll pull right in there and park my vehicle, and the deer don't think twice about that, because that's normal human activity. And it doesn't matter how much noise I make. In fact, you know, I might as well slam doors, and, you know, the more noise, the better. So that's one, I would say one thing for sure that I see people making the mistake is they underestimate how much attention deer pay to, especially in the mornings, to where we park. It's just an early warning to them.
When you think back about the lessons you've learned, even say in the last 10 years, whether it be new gear that's come out or something that's changed the way you hunt, that's made you more successful, that you could pass on, it could be a top lesson or a secret or something that you have done that's just really made you that much, you know, again, better, more successful. What would that be?
Well, for sure, it's the trail cameras. I was a little bit of a slow adopter to the trail cameras. And I guess I just figured, you know, hunting is hunting. You know, you should just go get into a tree and hope for the best, you know, and let your woodsmanship, you know, kind of guide your efforts and so forth. And but, you know, what I've found is that we started hunting, more individual deer, you know, going after certain bucks and, you know, creating a hit list of deer that we really would hope to, you know, get on during the season. And it was too frustrating trying to do that without more help. You're trying to pattern a deer that you know almost nothing about. You know, you've maybe, you know, you've seen him once cross the road or something like that. Now, all of a sudden, you're trying to make all these assumptions, you know, about where this deer lives and where he beds and where he feeds, and you have nothing to go by. And at the end of the day, you know, it's just discouraging. But with the trail camera, you may not, you know, get that deer pegged right down to, you know, where he beds and where he feeds, but you've got a real sense of how active that deer is within his home range and maybe a little bit about the size of his home range. So you'd know going into it, you know, whether this is a deer that you have any hope of shooting or not. You know, it's not going to make the hunt necessarily a lot easier for you. It's just going to maybe set your expectation in line with reality and give you a little bit more information on which part of the hunting property that you need to spend your most time in. Because you can tell by how many pictures you're getting and the time of day and so forth, whether a buck is active in his home range or whether he's inactive, which means basically, does he cover a lot of ground? If he's covering a lot of ground and he has a small home range, there's a pretty good chance I can kill that deer just by hunting the best stands in that area, not necessarily hunting right next to the camera or anything like that. But basically, that camera has told me which part of my hunting area has a buck that has the personality that makes him more vulnerable than others.
Well, we've gotten a lot of good information, but I want to ask you one more question before we go. How can we get a hold of, if someone wanted to get you for a speaking event or something of that nature, where would they, how would they contact you? Through the website?
Yeah, the website's probably the best way. Anybody that contacts through the website, that ends up, you know, ultimately it comes into our office and ends up, if it's intended for me, it ends up on my computer. So, that'd be the best way to do it. And that way I get one more visitor to the website and make my numbers look good.
Gotcha. Right. So it's Midwestern or MidwestWhitetails.com.
Midwest Whitetail, singular.
MidwestWhitetail.com. Got it?
Yep.
Okay. And my next question to kind of end things up with is, we had a really long conversation yesterday, which I really, really appreciated. And I got to hear a little bit about you, and I know we can't go into as much depth as we did yesterday, but we see guys on television or read their articles, and we don't get a chance to really know them as a person. And yesterday I heard your heart come through big time, and it was a question that I asked, and I want you, if you would, just to kind of just give us a brief kind of overview of that. But the question was this: why do you do what you do?
Well, the you know, that one kind of goes back, I think, to, you know, the very first question you asked, and that's, you know, how did you get into this business? You know, for me, you know, I mean, obviously at the end of the day, you have to pay the bills. So it's a job too. But, for me, I feel like, you know, God gave me this gift, you know, not necessarily the gift of being able to write, but the gift truly of him handing me a gift of being able to do what I love. You know, I can't think of too many people that I know who really love what they do, but I feel like I do. You know, that I can't really think of any career that would be better. And the beauty of it is I didn't really come up with this. You know, it wasn't my plan. You know, that's why I feel so good about it is, you know, if I'd sat down and diagrammed this whole thing, you know, I'd say, well, maybe this isn't, you know, what God really had in mind for me. But because I didn't really come up with it, I just stumbled sideways into it, almost kicking and screaming. You know, I realized that this is where God wanted me to be. And you know, as we talked about yesterday, there's kind of a point of being outside of your comfort zone that's a really healthy thing. And, you know, I certainly, and my wife included, we were well outside of our comfort zone when I got into this business, you know, down to $250. You know, it's going to force you to do some things that you wouldn't have otherwise done. But also, you know, as far as, you know, making that effort, you know, going that extra mile, you know, doing things that, you know, normally you might not have considered. But also beyond that is when you're outside of your comfort zone, that means you're moving, you're going someplace, something is happening, you know, and God can use that momentum. And even if it's directed, not necessarily in the perfect direction, there is momentum there and he can nudge that. by bringing other forces to bear, you know, bringing people into your life, bringing opportunities into your life, you know, presenting that next open door. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, I do this now because I know that this is what God wants me to do. You know, it's, you know, I started out doing it because I couldn't come up with another way to make $250 to buy groceries for the next couple of weeks, you know, but fortunately we're well past that. But now it's kind of the bigger picture, you know, of being able to interact with people like you and to be a Christian model to outdoorsmen and you know, ideally to advance God's kingdom here on earth.